From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior Political Analyst Brian Padden. Our topic on this edition of the program, political polarization in America and around the world. Our guest, Heather Hurlburt. She's director of the New Models of Policy Change Initiative at New America, an innovative think tank based in Washington. Formerly known as the New America Foundation, New America is a civic platform that connects a research institute, technology lab, solutions network, media hub, and public forum. Heather Hurlburt leads research into how policy advocacy can be effective under intense political polarization. She guides advocates and funders navigating politics on behalf of policy solutions. Previously, Heather Hurlburt ran the National Security Network, a premier source for foreign policy messaging and advocacy, and she held management positions at several not-for-profit international humanitarian organizations, such as the International Crisis Group, Human Rights First, and the One Campaign. Heather also served in the White House and State Department under President Bill Clinton, worked on Capitol Hill, and was a member of the U.S. delegation to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE. She is a foreign policy columnist for New York Magazine and co-founder of LC Wins, the Leadership Council of Women in National Security, an organization which advances gender equity in the national security workforce, especially its leadership. And Heather Hurlburt joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, VOA Senior Political Analyst, Brian Padden.
Thank you.
Well, Heather, let's begin talking about the New Models of Policy Change project on which you're working at New America. Tell us more about that.
The core insight behind it was that for the post-war and post-Cold War period, Americans were used to the idea that we made policy by people coming together in the center of the political spectrum and sort of compromising, and the idea that good policy came out of compromise where each side gave up something. Even a casual observer of our political scene today knows that that's not working very well, and that we have shifted toward a politics and a kind of polarization where being perceived to give anything up is fatal. Yet, you do still see in some areas, criminal justice reform is a big one that everyone likes to talk about, that Republicans and Democrats can work together across party lines to get important things done. And our idea is that where we're successful these days doesn't come out of me saying, well, I'm going to compromise and be less my ideology, but me saying I found a policy that I can tell my supporters fully represents our ideological views, and someone else can tell their very different supporters that it also fully represents their ideological views, so that you can, in fact, work with people that you disagree with very profoundly on specific ends without necessarily compromising over overall. And that kind of approach, actually, in an era where increasingly Americans are sorting and defining ourselves along identity and ideological lines, is going to offer a much more hopeful way forward.
But there are certainly topics on which this is very difficult, like gun violence and, let's say, social issues like abortion and so forth.
I'll give you an example of something that seems one of the most polarized areas in American life where you're actually seeing depolarization in interesting ways, and that is climate change. And again, it's been a trope of American politics for years now that views on whether climate change is real or not were very strongly divided on partisan grounds. That if you told me your partisanship, I could predict what you believed about climate change. That's not true anymore. In the past 3 or 4 years, and frankly, especially in the last couple of years after the last round of extreme weather we've had, belief in climate change has depolarized. And you can also find a set of policy solutions that get very strong support from both Republicans and Democrats. And frankly, the trick is to the extent that an idea is not already associated with one party or the other, partisans of both parties are prepared to like it. But once you tell them this is the Green New Deal associated with progressive Democrats, then Republicans know that they're supposed to hate it. Or if you say this is the free market response to climate change developed by libertarian Republicans, then progressive Democrats know that they're supposed to hate it. So where you've seen actual success in taking actual pro-climate and energy security policies has been mostly, obviously, not at the level of the federal government, but at the state and local level, where libertarians and liberals can work together, faith-based communities from both sides of the partisan divide can work together and do things like open the grid to competition, increase use of solar and wind power, and other pragmatic steps that nobody turns on their favorite talk show host and hears them yelling about, but that they're kept out of the partisan space or they're defined and marketed separately to partisans on different sides. So that's how, when it works, that's how it works.
I have a lot of questions, but let me turn to my colleague Brian for a question.
Well, it seems like by employing the language of diplomacy, whereby various parties can pretty much cast these decisions in lights that best benefit their constituents, seems to work. But if we move from climate change to immigration, there was, you know, an experience recently where Republicans, Democrats were coming together, and then the Republicans revolted against their own party and their own making of a deal because the loud voices within social media, constituency groups get into the process and make any sort of progress impossible.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned both of those points. I mean, first, because as Carol mentioned, I started my career in diplomacy. And so maybe it's natural that I bring the sort of no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, only permanent interests to everything that I do. But the falling apart of efforts to churn out an agreement on immigration, like, by the way, the falling apart of efforts at the federal level to get a climate bill back about a decade ago now, very similar profile of what happens where it's not so much a grassroots rejection of a policy. As Americans, we have these two large political parties that are so big and they cover so many different interests that they're hardly political parties in the classic, more narrow sense that you would find in countries that have a multi-party system, but instead they're coalitions of interest. So at any time, say within one party, a party's energy lobby is fighting its environmental justice lobby, or a party's solar power lobby is fighting its fossil fuel lobby. So if you think about the immigration one, where you had a part of the Republican Party that was very eager to make a deal, the sort of pro-business lobby that wanted a steady supply of workers, people from represented from certain parts of the country who just want this issue off the table, versus another wing of the party that derives power from its ability to harness anxiety and energy around this question. And if we think about politics as endless jockeying of coalitions, and then if as actors behind, say, an idea, whether that's immigration reform, whether it's education reform, and then you say, what is the coalition I can put together on this? And one of the real ways that governance in the United States has weakened over the last decade is that again and again, people who had managed politics from the center underestimated the ability of their opponents to undermine them within their own party. So we've seen where both Republicans and Democrats thought that they could control their own party from the center, and in the end, they couldn't. And I think that the immigration collapse you're referring to is a great example of that.
Heather, notwithstanding your efforts to bridge these divides, the polarization in this country, it seems like it's gotten much worse over the last years, particularly under the Trump administration. What are your observations about today's political climate, polarization, especially in contrast to your days in the Bill Clinton administration? Now, he was also impeached for very different reasons, but there was a sense of remorse, a sense of contrition, which we didn't see exhibited by President Trump. And now he is lashing out with retribution. We've seen several civil servants and public servants have been removed from their posts as a form of retribution. How do you see all of this, and are you concerned?
I've been in the business long enough that when I started out in foreign policy, it was absolutely normal to serve administrations of different political party. And in many cases, as incredible and naive as this sounds, we didn't know the political views of our colleagues in the foreign policy space. It was something incidental that maybe came up over drinks and maybe never came up. And that was normal. I used to tell young people coming to Washington, you get one party change, now you don't get any party change. So the degree to which every aspect of American government and American life has been caught up in this kind of splitting and defining, where in comparison to the rest of the world, we had very strange political parties in that they were very mixed. And you tended to belong to a party based on maybe what party your parents had belonged to, or the tradition of your town or where you lived. And you had enormous ideological overlap through the 60s. And then in the 70s, the process that we're seeing now in the extreme form that you describe really starts after the civil rights movement, when there starts to be a massive realignment, first in the South and then in other places, where we start seeing people identify party membership first with racial identity in the South, and then slowly over the last couple of decades, we've had some mass migrations along religious lines, less so along gender lines. But so that now, if you tell me your level of education, your ethnicity, I can predict pretty strongly what your political affiliation is going to be, which at the same time has increased the number of things that we think political parties should tell us what we think on, which goes back to the question about how do you keep an issue from getting polarized. There's a wonderful piece of research that came out after the 2012 elections that was actually commissioned by Republicans thinking about why their candidate lost. And they asked young people, who do you think are the leaders of the party? And for young Republicans, it was talk show hosts and radio hosts. So one of the things that has happened in polarization is that first we have sorted ourselves so that we encounter fewer and fewer people who think differently from us. And second, we are, instead of, again, taking our cues from the kind of centrist establishment figures that we maybe think of in the past, we are now, as a society, taking our cues from voices that tend to be maybe more dissociated from the actual consequences of decision making. And that tends to accelerate polarization. And I think that helps you explain how we got to the point where that you described, where instead of being seen as a nonpartisan entity, government employees are now presented as active participants, very much against their will, in this sort of polarized conflict.
How do you bridge this gap where right now you say on local levels, in certain situations, there's some common ground and some common sense solutions being proposed where it's not particularly politically polarizing issue or at a lower level of an issue. Yet the parties that we have now are moving in the other direction. We're very much polarized. We're very much moving farther apart. And the parties benefit from that. How do we get to the point where the parties benefit from cooperation rather than competing? Well, or not.
Here again, actually, the examples from international affairs are really interesting. And really, the best way we know that depolarization happens is when presented with a larger outside threat. And I actually think that this is one of the ways that depolarization is happening on climate change, that as more people really started to see what extreme weather looked like in their communities. The other way that we see depolarization happening, and this example comes actually both from recent elections in Nigeria and in Kenya, where you had countries that really people feared were so politically polarized as to be on the brink of cataclysmic mass violence. And the way that's been described by people who were on the ground at the time is they said, we looked into the abyss and we didn't like each other or agree with each other anymore, but we all saw the same abyss. And so obviously my work mostly tends toward ways of helping people identify a common external opponent in the case of climate change. But I think something that particularly relevant for people who work in media is the question of how can we all see the abyss the same way? How can we all see together the consequences of the kind of never-ending spiral that you describe?
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Heather Hurlburt, director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at New America. That's a think tank based in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, John Maluk from Juba, South Sudan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Heather Hurlburt. And Heather, you were talking just before the break about looking into the abyss and recognizing that we have nowhere to go but perhaps to come back together. But I don't see that personally here in the United States in the wake of President Trump's impeachment and then lack of removal by the Senate from office. We're seeing a doubling down and the Republican Party just basically going along with him, exacerbating the polarization and even using conspiracy theories that have been debunked and disinformation promoted by Russia, saying that, for example, Ukraine was responsible for the interference in our 2016 election when it was documented by 11 U.S. intelligence agencies and confirmed by the Mueller report that certainly it was Russia. The Republicans have abandoned so many of their previous bedrock principles of free trade, deficit reduction, even promotion of democracy and free press in favor of these types of conspiracy theories, presumably to please Mr. Trump and to remain in power. They are multiplying these theories on social media platforms. Now, we know there's always some exaggeration in campaigns, some hyperbole. We're in the election season. They're all trying to enhance their prospects. But it seems to many analysts that what is happening with Mr. Trump and the Republicans in this case, that they're crossing the line into disinformation. How do you react?
First of all, to say that it's very humbling to have you give a shout out to a listener in South Sudan and be and be reminded just how deep the abyss is and just how courageous human beings can be in confronting it. So, you know, ironically, I don't think this was your purpose when you framed the question, but we Americans told ourselves for decades that we were special and different, or that our system of government was, and that some of the dynamics and dangers of polarization and disinformation that we saw happening in other societies could never happen here. So one of the things that gives me both great concern but also great cause for optimism is that there is so much we can learn from how other societies have dealt with these kinds of situations. And I'll start by looping back to the Kenyan and Nigerian examples I mentioned, because both of those were in contexts that were equally fraught and terrifying. I mean, in many ways, much more terrifying for those societies than the prospect of this year and the possibilities for ratcheting up of tension and, frankly, concerns about political violence here that you see. So on the one hand, the thing about the U.S. is that we still do have tremendously strong institutions. I mean, frankly, including the fact that we're having this conversation on Voice of America, tremendously strong institutions at the state and local level and a tremendous civic memory. So those are all things that we're going to need to draw on. I am very, very concerned. And one of the reasons that I say yes to as many media opportunities as I can is to have this conversation as often as possible so that, again, we are all thinking about what are the consequences of our actions and our choices. And one of the things, again, that we see in societies that have either successfully turned back from the brink or that have not succeeded in turning back, but that have rebuilt themselves later, is where you have both high-level government change. So I think you rattled off a whole lot of distressing things that are happening at the highest levels of government that many of us in a nonpartisan way had hoped we would see more response to. But that's not sufficient without also in media, in state and local government, in faith communities at all levels, an effort to really try to rebuild a sense of norms and institutions. So we're going to have to do both together here in the U.S.
We have our social media platforms like Facebook reneging on correcting obvious falsehoods on political ads. So that's also worrisome, a platform which is used with algorithms and by nefarious actors to promote disinformation, now saying that, well, it's a free market, we're not going to get involved. And that doesn't help to disabuse people of the kinds of conspiracies and so forth that are being disseminated on either side of the political aisle.
Yeah, and I think it's worth mentioning here again that, for example, Finland has a really interesting program where every young person gets a pretty serious curriculum in spotting disinformation, and that we actually can learn quite a lot from how other countries are handling this problem, and that although we feel that we've never been through anything like this before, and there's no question that the speed with which disinformation can travel is really different from anything we've encountered. But in an ironic way, our society, which is so technologically advanced, and we're all so wired and so turned on, but we're now able to create information bubbles for ourselves, so that in some ways the challenge is not fundamentally different from what we've seen in very rural or isolated societies where people have only one source of information that's feeding them hate speech and incitement. So again, we can go back and learn from people who have had this experience in very different contexts.
A very good point. And I think we should mention this week that Transitional Military Council in Sudan is turning over Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, which is really an incredible act of courage.
An amazing thing to see about how really foundational aspects of the international system and of ideas about human rights and justice are working, even in this moment where they seem to be challenged from so many levels.
I want to ask you about the notion of individual responsibility in here. You touched on that. Your organization is somewhat of a Democrat-leaning organization, and I think journalists to a certain degree and Democrats to a large degree had to kind of do a reassessment after President Trump won election and kind of look at some of the issues that that side was pushing for on immigration and such that might have been considered very controversial or very extreme. And they were brought more into the mainstream. Do Democrats on your side, do Republicans on their side, is there a need for them to kind of recognize the other side and say, hey, I need to legitimize some of your concerns on some of these issues?
What you just said is the most fabulous example of how polarization works, because actually when New America was founded, it was founded by people who were trying very hard to avoid partisan labels and who really wanted to position the organization as, if not centrist, then floating slightly above or apart from partisan politics. But in an age of polarization, that is not possible. And I am under orders from my bosses to protest vigorously whenever anyone describes us as left of center, but we get described as left of center all the time, and that is because of how ideas have gotten associated with political leaders. So just to note that that is absolutely part of the totalizing kind of polarization that we're having. Again, successful cases where societies are depolarized or a spiral toward violence is interrupted. Two things happen. One is that opposing groups, as you say, recognize and acknowledge each other. And we have vehicles where, not necessarily, again, that you decide you agree with me on an issue, but I know I can speak to you about my perspective and you at least recognize me as fully human and a full participant in our shared society. So that kind of bridging platform is critically important. The other piece is intra-group dialogue, which is where you are able to say to your colleagues in the chocolate eclair party, don't do that, that's extreme, that's outside our shared norm in the chocolate eclair party. So both of those dynamics, both the external bridging and the internal ability to maintain norms within your own group, are a little bit under threat in the U.S. right now.
And we saw that during the 2008 election with Senator John McCain when he cautioned one of his own supporters to say, who was calling then-candidate Barack Obama a Muslim. She called him an Arab, and he corrected him and said, no, he's a good man. We have some political views we disagree on, but we're both good Americans for the most point.
Right. Or I would contrast recently Representative Lynn Cheney saying that the president shouldn't go after Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Other Republicans shouldn't question the value of his service, as compared to people who chose to say that there were very fine people among the murdering neo-Nazi protesters in Charlottesville.
But for the most part, we're not seeing that from this present administration. We're seeing a very strong attack mode for any sort of criticism, which I guess heightens and and sharpens any sort of divide. And there was criticism back in the Obama years that he was too arrogant and not willing to work with Republicans. Is there a formula for getting parties together at the highest level? Forget the lowest level. Can this government function at the high levels and produce results?
So no, we can't function at high levels right now. But actually, in part because we know from international conflict resolution experience that if you're just trying to do it at the high levels, you fail. That the interesting part is, and also if you try to do only grassroots peace building, that will also fail because the people at high levels have their interests. And if you are working against their interests, they have power to contravene that. What actually works, and again, whether it's the US or anywhere else, is that you're going to have a both and, where somebody like Ivanka Trump or Tom Cotton or other sort of future Republican politicians or any of the many, many Democratic contenders that we could name right at the moment believe that it will be in their political interest to be seen working with the other side. That's a sort of both and approach. I also want to say that we know from international experience that the phenomenon you described, when people within a party stop being able to police their fellows, or when they start being criticized and ostracized for attempting to uphold norms, that's a very dangerous moment historically. That when moderates, quote unquote, within a party lose power to uphold norms, that's a moment that you're really headed for danger.
I think we are headed for danger, given, for example, Republican Senator Mitt Romney's vote to convict President Trump in the Senate, the sole Republican vote, and now he is being vilified, ostracized. Perhaps he maybe even needs security. This is dangerous, a very scary moment we're living in. We know that Colonel Vindman, even before he was removed from the White House, he had to have security personnel. I think Adam Schiff, the Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee and the chief manager of the impeachment inquiry, needs a major security guards. Because Mr. Trump in particular has called him corrupt, lying, and vilified him to the point where his followers who are blindly following him might take up action against him, might, in fact, there was an attempt on his life. Adam Schiff.
I was working in the State Department during the Clinton impeachment, and it's very striking to me to think back that there were publicly reported stories. The female members of the cabinet kind of ambushed the president and laid into him about their distress at his failure to uphold the dignity of the office. There was an ongoing public debate among Democrats as well as Republicans about whether he should serve out his term, whether he should resign, whether he should be convicted. The votes in both the House on impeachment and in the Senate on conviction were mixed. Partisan, and that it was considered perfectly politically viable to be a Democrat or a Republican who thought either way about that. And it's only 20 years ago, astonishingly to me. So that really how relatively quickly what we thought was a bedrock of American politics. I mean, the reason that I have a research program at all is that we didn't think American politics was like this. So this is still kind of new and surprising.
Indeed, and we're seeing these kinds of divides in foreign policy. What were once bipartisan issues like Middle East peace have become terribly politicized, or even trade. Even President Obama was promoting the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have thwarted China and its nefarious and unfair trading practices, its use of intellectual property. But Mr. Trump decided to withdraw from that and engage in a trade war, and now tariffs and so forth. Again, it's infecting all kinds of areas.
And this is shocking and difficult for our international partners to understand, frankly, who have often assumed that there's an enormous continuity in U.S. foreign policy. And it's gone from being one of the least polarized issues in American life. As you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, there were issues such as abortion, such as criminal justice, such as health care, that have for a long time been very ideological. But traditionally, foreign policy, national security wasn't one of those issues. But now, if you look at the polling, it's actually among one of our most polarized issues, with some dizzying flips, like how opinion on Russia flipped ideologically right around the time of the 2016 elections. That before that, basically forever since post-World War II, Republicans have been more hostile to Russia and Democrats have been more accepting of or comfortable with Russia. And that flipped, you know, within a matter of months. It's just fascinating to watch.
Well, we'd love to have you back to talk more about those wonderful stories. Heather Hurlburt is a former senior government official, now director of the New Models of Policy Change Project at New America's Political Reform Program. Heather, thanks again for coming in, for your time and terrific insights.
Thanks for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.